I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. This show explores the rich heritage of the Brandywine Valley outside Philadelphia, focusing on the people, places, and events over more than 300 years, which have played an important part in our American heritage. Each show highlights a local town, event, or personality who's had a notable influence on our culture. And before we get started, I want to mention that our call-in line, if you have questions or comments, is 610-701-9243. That's 610-701-9243. This day in history, February 22nd. On this day in 1732, a man who would literally change the course of human history was born in Westmoreland County, Virginia. George Washington was the second son of a colonial planter. His life was one of dedication to his country. After serving in the French and Indian War, he joined the Virginia House of Burgesses and later concurred with calls for independence from England. Due to his military experience, he was chosen to lead the Continental Army, and although beset with many challenges, he was victorious in the Revolutionary War. On this day in 1946, Charge d'Affaires George Kennan sends a long telegram totaling 8,000 words to the U.S. State Department regarding trends unfolding in the Soviet Union. Kennan was harsh in his appraisal of the regime led by Joseph Stalin, who he deeply mistrusted despite President Truman's efforts toward friendly relations. Kennan's hardline views eventually held sway in America's Cold War policy that unfolded from the late 1940s through the 1970s. And in 1980, a group of college students defeats the much-heralded Soviet hockey team in one of the biggest upsets in Olympic history. The miracle on ice was accomplished by Herb Brooks, a former Olympic hockey player himself, who crafted together talented individuals from schools across the country and trained them relentlessly. The feat was captured in the superb film Miracle, a riveting and dramatic portrayal of their very exceptional achievement. People around the world have embraced flying as a means to visit exotic places in distant lands. Aside from taking a long cruise on a ship, airline travel is basically the only option available if people want to visit other continents. The golden age of air travel was the 1950s through the 1970s, when airlines used many enticing features, including good meals, generous discounts, and accommodating scheduling options to lure travelers across the U.S. and around the world. The terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001 changed all that. Since that time, airlines across the globe have dealt with numerous challenges, instituting changes which have made travel just a tad different than it was when we were all a bit younger. One person who's seen the many changes over the years is Dale Mincer, a pilot with U.S. Air with more than 40 years of travel and flying experience. Dale's perspectives were formed from the 1970s through recent years as he traveled around the country and to other nations. He's even met Sully Sullenberger, the U.S. Air colleague who engineered the exceptional landing on the Hudson in January 2009 when his plane's engines malfunctioned after being struck by birds, an event depicted recently in the film Sully. Dale's many experiences are fascinating to hear as they cover several milestones in airline and American history, and he's with us today to talk about them. Dale, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Gene, for having me on your show today.
It's a pleasure. Before we get going further, I wanted to mention, I give a special hello to Phyllis Recca, Corrine McCauley, and our other friends who are listening in today. Dale, when did you first get interested in flying?
Well, most of my life, my dad was a Navy pilot in World War II, so I kind of grew up in an aviation family. He got out of the Navy in 1955 and continued commercially flying, so I kind of grew up in an aviation family. I thought all dads flew airplanes and were gone for weeks at a time. He would take me out to the airport, and so I just kind of fell in love with flying and the whole idea of going up there and traveling all my life, actually.
Mm-hmm. So. Now, did you have any official training, like military training courses, anything like that?
I went to Flight Safety International after college down in Florida, mm-hmm. and it takes about a year and a half to get your basic flying ratings. You have very little experience. You just learned, and then you have to work your way up the experience ladder. I taught in little airplanes as an instructor, then got a job at the commuter airline out of Philadelphia, and then got on with U.S. Air in 1980.
Okay. Your official commercial airline industry experience began around 1980, is that right?
Well, the commuters I flew for those, they were small airlines. That started in 1976.
Oh, 76. A little over 40 years.
Over 40 years.
Yeah. Now, these commuter airlines, these are more kind of localized, regional?
Yeah, they are. They're smaller. Back when I was learning how to fly and then got on with those, they're mostly turboprops, propeller airplanes, and they flew most. Mostly, I flew for an airline called Altair that's gone out of business, and we're in Philadelphia, the commuter. And we flew basically as far north as Boston and far south as Richmond, but okay. Basically within an hour or two of Philadelphia.
Okay, basically an East Coast airline.
Northeast, yes.
I've flown across the U.S. many times, and some of the small airlines that I used to take, I'm not sure if they're still around any. There was one called Big Sky. Is that Montana, that area?
Yeah.
Are they still around?
No, a lot of the airlines have merged and gone out of business or been mm-hmm. taken over by the big airlines, mm-hmm. but there's still a few around. I remember Big Sky, but I don't believe they're in operation mm-hmm. anymore.
How about Frontier, I think, is still in
operation. Frontier was bought and merged into Continental, which they mm-hmm. became part of United Airlines.
Okay, just curious, I have to ask this. Did you know anyone who flew for Pan Am, the world-renowned international airline?
Yes, I did.
No kidding. They were the big international player
right.
for many years.
When I flew for the commuter airline in Philadelphia, we had one route on our small airplanes. We would go Philly to JFK.
Mm.
And then we would be handled by the Pan American group. Mm. So I got to walk down in their crew room and, mm-hmm. and talk to some of their older pilots and hear a lot of the stories about the gentleman who flew the old Clippers back in mm-hmm. the 50s mm-hmm. and traveled the world and the first flights into Moscow. So it was quite education for me. I enjoyed it very much.
So when you started with U.S. Air, again, it was a different era, really, 1980, quite different from what we know today. Tell us a little bit about your experiences at U.S. Air, the organization, the way they do their business.
Yeah, it was relatively small back when I got hired. We had less than 1,000 pilots, and we basically were an East Coast on a Florida airline. And the big change in U.S. Air and a lot of the airlines was the industry was regulated back then. The government regulated what the airline did as far as their routes, what they could charge.
Mm-hmm.
And under Jimmy Carter back in the late 70s, they deregulated the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so it grew quite a bit. Airlines could now fly to many cities they couldn't before. The government mm-hmm. wouldn't approve it for various reasons. So a lot of expansion has taken place. And that's good and bad on mm-hmm. passengers' mm-hmm. experience.
Mm-hmm.
But now U.S. Air eventually turned and we merged with American Airlines. We went from 1,000 pilots to about 15,000 pilots mm. when I retired a
that's
couple
huge.
Years ago.
Yeah, that is
the largest
huge.
In the world.
Is that right? They are the largest. Now, they also merged with, many years ago, PSA?
U.S. Air back, deregulation started back in the late 70s and allowed a lot of the smaller, we call regional airlines like PSA, U.S. Air, North Central, a lot of those airlines started to merge so they could get the size to compete with the Americans
mm-hmm.
back then. So U.S. Air merged with Piedmont Airlines mm-hmm. and PSA back mm-hmm. in the late 80s,
mm-hmm.
and we grew through a merger. A lot of other smaller airlines did also.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Tell us, again, since you were in the airline industry for so many years, a majority of your life, really, tell us about your just overall impressions of the industry. What are its major strengths? What are its weaknesses? What do you think about it?
It's weaknesses. It's not a whole lot of weaknesses. Financially, there was a lot of weaknesses because when they deregulated the industry, it was a highly unionized industry when I first got started, which means its costs were high. So when the deregulation came in, people could start own their own airlines and not pay quite as much,
mm-hmm.
not give quite the service. So they forced the larger airlines to compete with them price-wise because the new airlines had a much cheaper cost structure.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the there's a lot of labor turmoil in mm-hmm. the industry, especially in the late 80s, early 90s,
mm-hmm.
with a venture capitalist like Frank Lorenzo taking over attempting to take over various airlines.
Was that Continental? Was it?
He took over Continental, then they got involved with Eastern Airlines, and there were some strikes at Eastern, and just a lot of labor turmoil in the mm-hmm. industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the last 20-some years, the industry gone through a lot of changes, and it was a lot of stress and strain on the pilots and the flight attendants and the people working for the airlines mm-hmm. because you weren't quite sure, are they going to go bankrupt? You're going to have a job in a year or two. So that was kind of the downsize. The upside to flying was you could, from a flight crew standpoint, you know, see a lot of cities and meet a lot of people. And, mm-hmm. You know, that was there's a lot of good people in the industry, which mm-hmm. were fun to meet.
I bet it's fascinating. Yeah. Just curious, did you, as a U.S. air pilot or otherwise, ever fly internationally?
We flew to Canada, Mexico, flew to the Caribbean.
Okay.
We were mostly a North American airline.
Mm-hmm. So does U.S. Air fly to Europe?
We did, starting maybe 15 years ago out of Philadelphia and Charlotte. Mm-hmm. Now when we merged with American, there's a lot of flying to Europe mm-hmm. Out of JFK, which was the American hub,
okay.
out of Philadelphia, Dallas, mm-hmm. Chicago.
Okay, now we've only got 1 minute before we take a break. Tell us the idea of what the name a hub means. What does a hub mean for the airline and for commuters?
Well, it allowed the secondary cities, like, let's say, Albany, New York. Let's say you wanted to fly to Los Angeles. Well, there wasn't enough people going from Albany to Los Angeles, so they would have a hard time having a flight.
Mm.
So what they decided to do was, let's say, have Philadelphia your hub. They would fly you down to Philadelphia from Albany and also from Syracuse, and they would all meet. It looked like a bicycle wheel, all the little spokes coming into Philadelphia, and all those airplanes and little cities would arrive about the same time. Then they would schedule one big airplane going to Los Angeles.
Mm.
So 4 people from Albany's flight, 6 people from other cities can all get on an airplane and fly to various places. So that was called a spoken hub system.
Okay, and that's pretty standard these days, is that correct?
It's pretty standard. It allows, like I say, the smaller cities to have to get you to within the same maybe half a day or a day to the larger cities.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Thanks so much. We are going to be right back after a commercial break. We're talking with Dale Mintz, a 40-plus year pilot with U.S. Air. We'll be right back with Living History.
Do you have a wedding, graduation, baptism, confirmation, milestone, or birthday to plan? You need John Surratt Catering, one of the most highly rated and preferred caterers throughout the Philadelphia area. They will be there to create and cater your event while assisting as much or as little as you desire. Planning a decadent, over-the-top company gala? Need help transforming your backyard into the party of the year? Want to wow your clients with a delicious luncheon? Then you need John Surratt Catering. All you have to do is call and they'll handle the rest. Located at 835 Lincoln Avenue in Westchester, visit them at SurrockCatering.com or call 610-640-2836. That's 610-640-2836.
If you had to choose a roofer, would you choose one with limited experience and knowledge, or would you choose a roofer certified as a master elite contractor by the largest manufacturer in the nation, GAF, a distinction shared by only 3% of the nation's roofers? I'm talking about GP Martini Roofing, who also does siding, windows, doors, and offers an ironclad guarantee that he'll repair or replace any roof for defects within its normal life. GP Martini Services, Chester, Delaware, Bucks, and Montgomery counties, with free estimates and consultation, and does both commercial and residential. Go to their website at martiniroofing.com for special savings, or call 610-873-1696. And also, financing is available with no payments for a full year. Now, what roofer would you call? GP Martini is the answer. 610-873-1696.
You're listening to WCHE 1620 AM, bringing you all things Chester County.
I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. Today we're talking with Dale Mincer, a 40-plus year pilot with experience at U.S. Air. Dale, over your 40-plus year career, what are the most important changes that you've seen, aircraft design, safety, operating procedures, that kind of thing? What are the things that stick in your mind as the biggest changes in the airline industry?
The biggest change is standardization with the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, has got involved more with the airlines to regulate how we operate. From the time I show up at work, we had to be there an hour before our flight leaves, to about 20 minutes after we leave. Everything we do is regulated by the government. We have to sign in, check the weather, and make sure the aircraft is ready for operation. Safety, the standardization, and most of the rules we have, all the airlines go by that also. Mm-hmm. So the government's got more involved, which is a good thing, to standardize the operations. Mm-hmm. And the airplanes have always been safe, mm-hmm. but they've added a few rules and regulations to make it even safer as far as what kind of weather we can fly in and crosswinds and this kind of thing. But it's been relatively safe. I started flying in the early 70s, and it was very safe then, and they've just enhanced that. It's probably one of the biggest changes.
Sounds fair. Have you personally, as a pilot on board an airline, aircraft in flight, have you ever had any problems with violent passengers, people getting out of control?
Yes, a few times we have.
What happened?
Well, we had a flight from Pittsburgh to Las Vegas, and a gentleman got a little intoxicated and decided that he didn't like the flight attendant, a male flight attendant we had on board. So he hopped over the beverage cart. People have probably seen the flight attendants wheel the beverage cart up and down the aisle. He leaped over that. He was obviously intoxicated and started to attack the flight attendant. Fortunately, a few passengers kind of sat on him and held him, and we actually have handcuffs on the airplane. They're plastic.
Oh, my gosh.
The flight attendants can put on the person, and they kind of held him down.
They cuffed the guy.
They cuffed the guy, yeah, because he was quite a large gentleman. And one funny story, if you have time,
when
I first started flying, security wasn't quite as big as it is now on checking people getting on the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
So a woman got on, and she had what we thought was a baby in a swaddling blanket covering the whole baby.
Mm-hmm.
So about halfway through the flight, through the cockpit door, I hear this commotion going on in the back. It was actually a little Maurice's monkey that she got on the airplane. And it got loose and was jumping around the airplane.
Oh, my Lord.
Businessmen were swinging, you know, briefcases at it. So we finally had her corral it.
Did she pay for his seat?
No, that was the biggest issue. My boss wanted to know, did he pay for the seat? So, outside of that, here again, things are so regulated and checked, it's hard for anything to happen too much. And I did hear from a flight attendant on the ground before we left, and a passenger looked a little maybe intoxicated or maybe just not with it. We would try not to let him get on the flight because it's much easier to handle the problem on the ground.
Oh, absolutely.
Than once we get in the air.
Yeah.
So that was what we tried.
Have you ever had anybody get on board who either was a criminal or had a gun or anything like that, knife or anything?
No, we never had that. A few people have tried, but they get
stopped at the gate.
Stopped at the gate, hopefully, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you've never had to, thankfully, I assume, never had to deal with any kind of a terrorist event, anything like that?
No, we haven't.
Good for you.
No.
What is the, I'm assuming at some point in over 40 years of flying, you've had some kind of a mechanical malfunction of some sort. What sticks in your mind as something that appeared kind of challenging for you and functioning in an airplane?
Believe it or not, I've never had a mechanical problem. We've had a few warning lights that came on that would say there was a problem, and we would check it. A warning light came on. We put the landing gear down to land, and it said one of our landing gear wasn't down.
Mm.
So we could actually go back in the airplane I was on, a Boeing 737, have a little glass port in the floor, and we could open that up and see if the gear is down. We also flew by the tower and made sure it was down and locked.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of that, and that gets back to my earlier point, how safe it is, the airplanes are checked every day, mm-hmm. and before we leave each flight, the co-pilot or captain will walk around the airplane on the outside. So mm-hmm. they're mechanically checked out so thoroughly that mm-hmm. it's very seldom that you have a problem up with an airplane, mm-hmm. a mechanical problem.
Now, in the last year or two, we've seen a couple of planes have to land with, I don't know, their wheels didn't come down or, mm-hmm. or they blew a few tires or something like that.
Right.
That's pretty dangerous as well, is it not?
It can be, but airplanes are kind of, believe it or not, engineered to land with the gear up. Mm. They protect some of the fuel tanks mm-hmm. by the way they're engineered. It's a serious problem, mm-hmm. but it's not fatal.
Mm-hmm. What's the worst weather you've ever had to fly in where you thought, oh my gosh, this looks a little dicey?
A few thunderstorms, especially in early days in the smaller commuter airplanes. We can't get very high to get above the thunderstorms, so we had mm-hmm. to fly right. We had radar to get around them up to mm-hmm. a point. Mm-hmm. We've had some very turbulent times from thunderstorms, but in jets, you can usually get above it or around it with the radar we have now.
Mm-hmm.
But some turbulent times and sometimes very foggy landings, but we're all trained and the airplanes have instrument landing systems on them to get mm-hmm. us down safely.
Mm-hmm.
So,
your point earlier was very interesting. You mentioned that you had some warning lights come on and indicate that your wheels weren't actually down.
When a landing gear wasn't down.
Yeah. I mean, when you see, you've got a cockpit with a panel in front of you with just dozens and dozens of gauges and things like that. Mm-hmm. How do you know if what they're telling you is actually correct? Is there any way to do a kind of a manual check to say, well, this is accurate, this is not accurate?
If you see a warning light or situation, we actually carry a book on boards to go right to that problem. Mm-hmm. It's not left up to us to kind of figure it out on our own,
mm-hmm.
and it tells us what we should do next.
Right.
And even the newer airplanes with the computers will tell us a checklist of how to solve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
If we can't solve it, what to do. So
mm-hmm.
everything is regulated mm-hmm. by a checklist. And we also train before we get on the airplane for 2 or 3 weeks of ground school and maybe 2 or 3 weeks in a simulator, and they give us all these warning lights and landing gear not coming down, and as we mm-hmm. take off an engine doesn't work.
Mm.
So we're also trained and checked every year, a captain every 6 months to 8 months on all these problems. So
mm-hmm.
we've seen it ahead of time.
Yeah.
And we also have a book. We also can call on our radio to our maintenance department. So
mm-hmm.
we have a lot of support.
Oh, that is great.
If we have an issue.
You mentioned the kind of a checklist or booklet you can take a glance
mm-hmm.
at. That brings me to my next topic. You mentioned that you met Sully Sullenberger, another
yes.
U.S. air pilot,
yes.
Who I said in our introduction, he successfully landed his plane on the Hudson
mm-hmm.
after it was hit by, I think, a bunch of geese.
Correct.
And his engines had failed. And in the film, I'm not sure if this is accurate, but they said they didn't have time to go through the 14-point checklist, what have you. They just took a course of action and said,
right.
we're doing this. Now,
right.
I know you've met, tell us a little bit about, you mentioned that you've met him. Had any thoughts about him and what happened?
I just met him in our crew lounge, didn't know him that well, but he's portrayed as a cool, calm character, and that's the way he is in life. Very
mm-hmm.
kind of soft-spoken,
mm-hmm.
Older gentleman, kind of guy you'd want as your captain if you were getting mm-hmm. on an airplane.
Also a 40-plus year pilot,
yes,
I believe.
Yes, yeah, I believe he was in the military, I believe,
mm-hmm.
and he came with when we merged with PSA, a West Coast airline.
Mm-hmm.
So he had tons of experience,
mm-hmm.
and
The movie, which, by the way, if you haven't seen Sully, I highly recommend it. Very interesting movie. They do go through a pretty shaky time in the sequence where they in effect relive the event where they are hit by birds and the engines fail, and I won't ruin the movie, but the pilot pretty much takes over and says, we're doing this, and I guess there are examples where the pilot just doesn't have time to go through a checklist. He just has to use his or her experience to do what they think is best.
In this case, I flew the route he was taking off from LaGuardia, And he was probably only a few thousand feet up. So once you lose thrust in your engines, you got to keep the airplane moving. And so you have to start gliding down to keep your airspeed up. So he had to make a snap decision. He did try a few quick things to restart the engines, and they weren't working. So he had to make a quick decision. Do I try to make it back to LaGuardia or another little airport that was to his right? But he figured that he didn't have enough altitude to glide back to these airports. And if you don't make it to the airport, a lot of airports, there's maybe fields around it. So if you do land a little short, you're going to land in a field, which could be serious too. But around LaGuardia and the other little airports they wanted him to go to, they're just buildings. So if he didn't make it, he would have run into a building.
And it would have been could have been disastrous.
His second choice, he did an excellent job putting it in the water. As long as the airplane stays intact, it'll float, and everybody got out. So he did an excellent job.
A miracle, miracle on the Hudson. I've always wondered this. I think I know the answer, but just to get it right from a pilot, which is a harder landing, so to speak, on land, where you're crash landing, or on water? I mean, can they both be equally tragic?
Yes, if you hit water at the wrong angle, it's like running into a rock. On land, it just depends on the situation that you're facing at the time. Either one is not good. It'll tend to ruin your day.
Yeah, I bet. You know, we've got a lot of security measures that have been put in place, as you well know, after 9/11. Whatever you can share, what can you tell us about the security measures and the mechanical features now used on aircraft that deal with all these issues, terrorist threats and various things? What can you share that the kind of concerned passenger might want to know about in getting on planes today?
From a pilot standpoint, the cockpit door has been reinforced, and it's almost impossible to get in it. In the older airplanes, you might have been able to get in it, but now you have to have a code to get in.
So they can't shoot through the door with a gun, right?
It's bulletproof. And just the screening of the passengers. I know people don't like to wait in line much longer than they have to, but it's relatively safe. That the screening and the cockpit door is a very safe environment now to fly.
That's excellent. And real quickly, then we're going to take our ending break. What changes do you expect to see in airline travel in the next 10 years? Real short.
It's probably going to stay about the same. They can't do much, but from a safety standpoint, it'll stay the same.
You think any larger, faster planes, high-graded service, anything like that?
It's very expensive. I think what you see now is probably what you're going to see over the next 10 years. Maybe a few more options on getting to places, and maybe the international flying is going to increase, I think. But domestically, we pretty much saturated the markets on flying.
Very good. Dale, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. You were excellent. It was a lot of fun. Be sure to tune in next Wednesday, March 1st at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when guest host Lili Gaylor will be speaking with artist Jacqueline Beam and Nicole Skull about Brandywine Valley art scene. Thank you all for tuning in today to Living History.